Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the next couple of sermons, inshallah, I will talk about Amr bima'ruf and Nahya az Munkar, joining right and forbidding wrong. Let me begin with a few activities to get your mind really geared toward what Amr bima'ruf and Nahya az Munkar is all about. Joining the PTA in our kids' school, writing to a city council member about garbage disposal in our neighborhood, contacting a congressman about racial justice, joining a local demonstration to protest about global warming. We typically call all these activities civic duties. In Islam, however, these activities are religious duties. They are religious duties. They are all instances of the Quranic injunction, Amr bima'ruf and Nahy az Munkar. A lot of things that in the West people call civic duties, in Islam we call religious duties. In the West, these activities are typically called civic duties because religion is supposedly concerned with humans' inner world, with esoteric experiences, with spiritual matters, prayer, not PTA involvement, for example. Check out verse 71 in chapter 9 in the Holy Quran. I think this verse really brings out what I'm trying to articulate. وَالْمُؤْمِنُونَ وَالْمُؤْمِنَاتُ بَعْزُهُمْ أَوْلِيَاءُ بَعْزٍ يَأْمُرُونَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَيَنْحَوْنَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ وَيَقِيمُونَ الصَّلَاةَ وَيُؤْتُونَ الزَّكَاةَ. The believing men and believing women are protectors of one another, enjoin right and forbid wrong, perform the daily ritual prayer and give the alms. The verse specified some marks of men and women of faith, protecting one another, daily ritual prayer, salat, almsgiving or zakat, and it throws in another duty, enjoining right and forbidding wrong. Isn't that amazing? Daily prayers, almsgiving, also Amr bima'ruf and Nahy az Munkar. These are all authentic religious acts. Amr bima'ruf and Nahy az Munkar is not a one-off Islamic teaching for social participation in the name of religion. This is part of a much bigger picture. This is part of the grand vision of Islam. It has to do with Islam's model of religion. And if I may say so, Islam is quite unique in this respect. So this is going to be the topic for the discussion today. This grand vision of Islam for human life. A vision that, in my humble opinion, is quite unique among all world religions, and that's why a lot of Western scholars of religion have problems with Islam. Because this view, the Islamic view of religion, is sort of alien to them. So today, our task is to look at the big picture in Islam. It's not about a given verse in the Quran. It's just the big picture. The structure of religious thought in Islam. If I succeed in articulating what is up here in my mind, you will have a very good key to unlock the mysteries of the Quran. Inshallah, next time I will do a deep dive into Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar, enjoining right and forbidding wrong. So let's begin. Most Western scholars of religion have difficulties with Islam. They are even hard-pressed to classify Islam as an authentic religion. Why? Why is it that they have such a hard time with Islam? Because the Quran talks about issues that in their view have nothing to do with religion. For example, the Quran talks about war. Well, war is typically discussed in political philosophy. The Quran talks about hygiene or women's menstrual period. Well, that's medicine. The Quran talks about using our eyes and ears to observe nature and learn. Well, what do we call that? Science. You get my drift? Islam just does not fit the bill. Islam adamantly refuses to departmentalize the human and the human life. Islam does not break up the human life into parts and say, okay, this part is the domain of religion and these parts are the domain of non-religion. Islam views the human as a whole, as a unity. Ooh, that essential Islamic principle again. Unity, oneness, tawhid. See, tawhid is not simply a metaphysical belief. Right? It is not. It is more of a worldview. I think this vision of Islam, tawhid, comes out clearly in the legend of the creation of Adam, the original human prototype. It's a legend, not an actual story. Chapter 15 of the Quran covers this legend, verses 26 through 29. وَلَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنْ صَلْصَالٍ مِنْ حَمَئٍ مَسْنُونٍ. We created human from dried clay, formed from dark mud. So that's one component of the human, okay, the material aspect of the human, made from dried clay. And then the Quran says, فَإِذَا سَوَّيْتَهُ وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِي فَقَعُوا لَهُ سَاجِدِينَ. When I fashioned him and breathed my spirit into him, I asked the angels, bow down before man. Angels had to bow down before the human because the human is the height of God's creation. She has a perfect composition. The composition of the human is made of matter and spirit. The human form is the height of the unity of matter and spirit. In this legend, body stands for the human need for materialistic pursuits. From food, sex, and hygiene all the way to finance, work, marriage, law, government. The Quran validates these pursuits and asks Muslims that we need to take them seriously. Right? These are very serious pursuits. Let me make a super, super, super critical point here. The Quran does not have rules necessarily for all these pursuits like government, finance, so on and so forth. It doesn't have ready-made formulas for all of them, right? The Quran instructs us to use our aql, reason, to manage these pursuits. These are all rational endeavors. Yet, Islam considers reason to be a continuation of revelation, wahy. This is super critical. Inshallah, I will dedicate another sermon to this very important topic. Just suffice it to say that according to Islam, human reason, aql, is a continuation of revelation or wahy. So Islam views body and spirit as two dimensions of the same reality. The reality which is called the human being. These two dimensions are not opposed to each other. In fact, human life is complete only and only if it includes both the human physical and spiritual desires. Denial of either the body or the spirit will result in misery. Denial of either one will cause us to be miserable. Just ask the medieval monks who castrated themselves. Just ask the priests who practice celibacy and end up sexually abusing children. That's what's happened when you negate and deny an essential aspect of human beings. I think the main reason the Western scholars have difficulty with Islam is that their view of what religion is has been shaped by Christianity. Super critical point. Their vision of what authentic religion is shaped by Christianity. Christianity was a revolt against the Judaic preoccupation with this world, with the material world. Judaic mind is concerned with a paradise on earth. Those of you who've read the book of Job in the Old Testament know that Judaism has a dream, the dream of justice, which must be realized not in the hereafter, but here and now, on earth. So for Jews, and here is a critical point, for Jews, the kingdom of God was to materialize on earth. Now, Jesus comes along and says, I am the promised Messiah of the Old Testament. And I tell you, my kingdom is not of this world. That's what we find in Gospel of John 18:36, right? Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. Christian theologians perfectly understood what Jesus preached. They concluded that human energy must not be broken down into two opposing directions, toward heaven, that is the world of spirit, and the earth, which is the world of the body. I personally think that Matthew articulated this Christian view perfectly. Gospel of Matthew 6:24. No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. You cannot serve God and mammon. Mammon, by the way, means material or worldly possessions. You cannot love God and this world. You have to pick one. Can't have both of them. Well, that's the Christian view. The other one was the Jewish view. How about Islam? What is the Islamic view? Islam is Judaism and Christianity combined. Muhammad is the unity of Moses and Jesus. The unity of this world, the material world, and the other world, the world of spirit. Islam puts equal emphasis on both of them. And this is really critical. Islam places equal emphasis on this world and the other world, the world of body, the material world, and the so-called spiritual world. And the Prophet Muhammad is the embodiment of this unity. Now I'm going to shift gear. The Prophet Muhammad himself is the embodiment of this unity. His prophetic ministry included both. His own life exemplified the Islamic ideal of the unity, which is the wholesomeness of the human life. That's why the Prophet Muhammad was interested not only in prayer, fasting, supplication, but also in politics, finance, law, and war. Yes, war. That's what civilization requires. Let me make a very important point here. Religion can affect the world only if it becomes worldly. Let me repeat one more time. Religion can affect the world only if it becomes worldly, if it is oriented toward this world. That is, if it becomes involved in politics in the broadest sense of the word. That was the vision of the Prophet Muhammad. Let me give you a quick overview of the Prophet Muhammad's vision and mission. Again, that is rooted in the principle of unity, Tawheed. As you know, according to the Holy Quran and Islam's oral tradition, one night the Prophet Muhammad ascended to the heavens, what we call Mi'raj, ascendance to heaven. That was an inner journey for the Prophet. It happened in his soul. He really didn't get on a rocket and go to the outer space. This experience happened in his soul and his consciousness. Mi'raj was what we call a unitary experience. It's a mouthful, but very critical. Mi'raj was a unitary experience for him. What does that mean? What does the unitary experience mean? Or in Farsi, تجربه توحیدی, تجربه اتحادی. Unitary experience is the climax of spiritual journey. That's when the person totally loses the sense of me or I. All the things that separate me from others suddenly vanishes. All personal distinctions at that moment go away. For example, what are our mark of distinctions, things that separate me from others? Well, things such as family background, ethnicity, race, rank, status, wealth, these are the kind of things that define me or I in the ordinary sense of the term. In Mi'raj or ascendance to heaven, the veil comes down and the person fully realizes that she is part of an infinite whole. There is no longer a sense of me versus others. One indivisible whole. Now, this is not what you and I perceive in daily life. In daily life, I see myself as an independent being with distinct qualities that separate me from others. I experience myself as an island, so to speak, among billions of other human islands. Isn't that how we see ourselves? One island in a vast sea of humanity among billions of other islands. And there is intense competition among these islands. That's what zoology teaches us, that we are in a struggle for survival, right? Unfortunately, modern materialistic science reinforces this notion that we are in a constant struggle for survival. Now, in some rare moments, you and I may get a glimpse of that unitary state. In some rare moments, we can have a low-grade unitary experience. When? When do we have these kind of unitary experiences? Well, in catastrophic times. In times of deep crises. When calamity happens. For example, when we are under attack. Our survival, our community is under an attack that will essentially destroy the community. That's when we feel that our fate is intertwined with the fate of others. We find ourselves to be on the same ship. If the ship sinks, we all perish. That's when we realize firsthand that we are intimately connected with a larger being. We realize that all those signs of distinctions, family, wealth, status, fame, all those signs of distinctions are absolutely arbitrary. They have no reality, no fact in our being. In ordinary life, this sort of vision has a short life. This kind of experience that we may have, low-grade unitary experience, has a short life. As soon as the ship reaches the shore of safety, we forget all about that real experience of oneness, unity, tawhid. We sink back into the world of multitude, or kisrat, or shirk. Now, just imagine for a sec, if that unitary experience would somehow become our consciousness. If somehow that unitary experience were to stay with us forever, that would be a life-altering event. And brothers and sisters, that's what precisely happened to the Prophet Muhammad. Mi'raj, his ascendance to heavens, left a permanent impression on his psyche, on his soul, and on his consciousness. That defining, monumental, unitary experience stayed with him for the rest of his days. From then on, he saw the world in a completely different light. Now, this unitary experience is the holy grails of spirituality. This is the ultimate wish of a mystic. Now, the question is this. What did happen to the Prophet Muhammad after Mi'raj? Well, as you can imagine, perhaps logically, the Prophet Muhammad must have retreated into himself to retreat from society and the rat race of life so he would not be tainted by the corruptive influences of the material world. That's what I submit to you, what most mystics would do, what most spiritual folks would do when you have such a life-altering experience. They want to protect it. They go deep inside themselves. They don't want to get out. They don't want to mingle with anybody else. Matter of fact, a Sufi Muslim in India by the name Sheikh Abdul Quddus Gangohi had an interesting observation about the Prophet Muhammad's Mi'raj. The late Allama Iqbal Lahori, in his masterpiece, The Reconstruction of Religious Thought in Islam, actually tells us about the observation of Sheikh Abdul Quddus Gangohi. Sheikh Abdul Quddus said, Muhammad ascended the highest heaven and returned. I swear by God that if I had reached that point, I should never have returned. Isn't that astonishing? Sheikh Abdul Quddus says, I swear by God that if I had reached the height that Muhammad reached in his spiritual journey, I would have never returned. This perhaps differentiates between the prophetic and the mystic types of consciousness. The mystic does not wish to return from his high. And even when he has to return, his return does not mean much for humankind. But the Prophet Muhammad returns and he inserts himself into history. He wants to transform the human world. He aspires to change the world. The Prophet Muhammad comes back from the heavens to create a new world based on his experience of unity, oneness, tawhid, which pervades the universe. That oneness pervades unity. Prophet Muhammad said, why should the human world, the human life, not mimic what goes on in the universe? Right? That was his vision. He now had a mission, not unlike what Hafez had in mind. This poem of Hafez is so famous, and I'm sure many of you have heard. بیا تا گل برافشانیم و می در ساغر اندازیم فلک را سقف بشکافیم و طرحی نو در اندازیم اگر غم لشکر انگیزد که خون عاشقان ریزد من و ساقی به هم تازیم و بنیادش براندازیم. حافظ says, come, let's scatter flowers and fill the glass to brim with wine. Let's split heaven's ceiling with our powers and try a wholly new design. If sorrow's soldiers incite to shed the lover's blood, with the beloved I will unite and uproot their foundation. Isn't that amazing? He wants to split the heaven's ceiling with his powers to try a grand new design. That's precisely what the Prophet Muhammad had in mind. Now we have arrived at the main point of my talk. You cannot transform society. You cannot create civilization without power. You want to change the world? You must have power. Without power, you cannot create anything. Creation without power is impossible. That's why one of God's beautiful names in the Holy Quran is Al-Qadir, all-powerful, right? God is Khaliq, creator. He is also Qadir, all-powerful. God can create because he is all-powerful. Contrary to most spiritual philosophies, the Quran does not have a dim view of power. We often associate power with corruption, right? That's what we do. Many of us, many mystics actually, many Sufis shied away from power, from the affairs of this world, because they did not want to be tainted by the corruptive influences of power. The Quran, however, does not have a dim view of power. God Almighty is the creator, right? He created the heavens and the earth. He is all-powerful, yet he is not corrupt. Listen to this fascinating verse in the Holy Quran that really articulates what I'm just sharing with you, that power does not necessarily corrupt. I have been fascinated, mesmerized by this verse in the Quran for many, many years. Chapter 62, verse 1. يُسَبِّحُ لِلَّهِ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ. Everything in the heavens and the earth glorifies God. Okay, so who is this Allah whom the entire universe glorifies? The verse continues and describes Allah with four absolutely amazing attributes. Al-Malik al-Quddus al-Aziz al-Hakim. Allah whom the entire universe glorifies is number one, Malik. Malik literally means king. But what sort of king is Allah? Al-Malik al-Quddus. He is a pure king. Quddus means pure. Allah, the king, is not crooked. He doesn't take advantage of his creation. His intentions, his acts are absolutely pure. God is not like most earthly kings who are often corrupt. Matter of fact, the Quran does mention the exact same point that many earthly kings are corrupt. Chapter 27, verse 34. إِنَّ الْمُلُوكَ إِذَا دَخَلُوا قَرْيَةً أَفْسَدُوهَا. When kings enter a town, they corrupt it. But God does not corrupt. God does not get corrupted. Because he is pure. Al-Malik al-Quddus. God is not abusive. He does not exploit his creation for personal gain. Now, in addition to being pure, God is also Aziz, mighty. Al-Malik al-Quddus al-Aziz. God has infinite power to see his design through. Now, power without purity becomes oppressive, right? Power without purity becomes oppressive. But purity without power is lame. You can't do anything with that purity. That's the predicament of good people in this world. People who have a pure heart, but no power to recreate this world on their own image of goodness. So in frustration, They have to watch the evil to control the world. One last attribute of this divine king. Al-Hakim, wise. Al-Malik al-Quddus al-Aziz al-Hakim. God is wise. Without wisdom, power will destroy. Now, in a nutshell, power will be creative, not destructive. It is tempered with purity and wisdom. Let me repeat one more time. Power will not destroy. Power will be creative if it is tempered with purity and wisdom. That's what the Prophet Muhammad's vision for involvement in politics was all about. After his enlightenment and spiritual awakening, the Prophet Muhammad did not retreat from this world as Christian, Buddhist, and Hindu monks would typically do. The fancy word for such isolation is called monasticism or ruhbaniyat. Monasticism is a way of life in which the person renounces worldly pursuits. He devotes himself to spiritual work, to prayer, just to save himself, which in my opinion is another form of egotism, selfishness, right? Just to care about yourself, to save yourself. The Quran criticizes this practice among the Christians. Chapter 57, verse 27. وَتَفَّيْنَا بِإِسَى ابْنِ مَرْيَمْ وَآتَيْنَاهُ الْإِنْجِيلِ وَجَعَلْنَا فِي قُلُوبِ الَّذِينَ اتَّبِعُوهُ رَأْفَةً وَرَحْمَةً وَرُهْبَانِيَّةً اِبْتَدَعُوهَا مَا كَتَبْنَاهَا عَلَيْهِمْ. We sent Jesus, son of Mary, and we gave him the gospel and placed kindness and mercy in the hearts of his followers. But monasticism, ruhbaniyat, was something they invented. We did not ordain it for them. In other words, the Quran says, we didn't ask the Christian to go and lock themselves up in a cave to save themselves from the blemishes of worldly life. We didn't say that. Prophet Muhammad was equally blunt. لا رهبانية في الإسلام. There is no monasticism in Islam. So let me summarize the main points of my sermon today about the big picture of Islam. I covered a lot of ground. Hopefully, you got the big picture of Islam. Here are the main points of my sermon. Number one, Islam is life. Islam is life. Its primary interest is human life. And human life is complex. Human life is multifaceted, multidimensional. It has countless moving parts and requirements. And these parts and requirements do not always sit together. The Quran essentially reflects the complex web of human life with all its inherent contradictions. The second point, Islam does not see reality or existence in terms of duality or dualism, sanaviyat. For example, body versus spirit, temporal versus spiritual, religious versus secular, this world versus the other world. This kind of duality and dualism has no place in Islam. Islam invites us to see and experience human life through the lens of unity, not duality. And thirdly, Islam despises division and disunity. Islam absolutely hates division and disunity. Division flies in the face of the vision of the Quran. In the eye of the Quran, whatever divides humanity is sheer evil. The Quran demands that Muslims work to bring down racial, ethnic, class, or even religious boundaries which separate humanity. That's why justice is such a sacred principle in Islam. Justice secures social harmony. Where there is social justice, there will be social harmony. There will be social unity. Amr bi ma'ruf and nahy az munkar, enjoining good and forbidding evil, is simply a mechanism to advance social justice. The philosophy of Amr bi ma'ruf and nahy az munkar is to spread the good and diminish the bad in our society, and that will promote unity and social cohesiveness and cohesion. Inshallah, we will visit this subject in my next sermon. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.